Lecture 16, Indian Parsis, Jews, and Christians.
Superficial impressions of India may make it seem like a Hindu nation, or at most, a Hindu nation with a substantial Muslim minority. But Indian society has long been far richer and more diverse than that. Numerous minority communities with their own particular religious and cultural traditions have for many centuries lived as parts of Indian society, identifiably separate and yet extensively interacting with the majority. This pattern makes South Asia particularly distinctive. Some of these minority communities originated and have developed within India, as we saw with the Jains and Buddhists. But other minority communities originally came from outside of India. They too have retained their individual distinctive identity within the larger Indian society. But in their case, it's especially due to their persistent identification with their original culture located outside of India. Such groups include the Parsis, Jews, and early Christians in India, whom we will discuss in this lecture. Some scholars have termed these latter types of settlers as trade diaspora communities. Such diaspora communities who have settled in India still retain continued cultural and commercial connections with their mother culture and with other sister colonies scattered elsewhere around the Indian Ocean. These connections to a transoceanic economy have provided them with some marked commercial advantages over their other Indian commercial groups who lacked such correspondence in distant ports. At the same time, the places and links within Indian society of these trade diaspora communities has also given them advantages over outside merchants who simply arrive on India's coast with no trusted, long-standing connections there. Since all three of the communities we'll discuss entered India from the west, they mainly can concentrate along India's western coast, although they have smaller settlements elsewhere on the subcontinent. First, we'll look at the Zoroastrians, generally known as Parsis, since they claim to have come from the Persian region called Fars. Next, we'll discuss Jewish communities, some of whom have been in India since ancient times. Finally, we'll consider the earliest Christians in India who claim to have been present in India for as long as Christianity has existed. When we consider the Indian Zoroastrian, Jewish, and Christian communities, we'll discuss their own emic understandings of their origins. How does the community explain the history of its location in a land so distant from their spiritual homeland with which they have continued links? How does the community explain its complex and long-standing relationships to the host Indian society? We'll also look at how outside scholars have reconstructed the past history of each of these three communities based on written records, ethnographic evidence, and even historical genetics. Minority communities anywhere need to highlight their distinctiveness from the rest of society, or else they will simply assimilate into the majority. At the same time, standing too separate from the rest often leads to unproductive isolation. However, Hindu society has long been distinctive because it consists of many different jatis. Each jati bonds internally through intramarriage and intradining. So a non-Hindu minority community can function internally much like a jati does and still interact with the rest of Indian society. In many ways, the Parsi community functions like a set of jatis, as do the other two communities that we'll discuss later in this lecture. This emphasizes one of the prominent features of Indian society. Some groups that arrive from outside can successfully take on many of the characteristics of Hindu society, like jatis, without necessarily becoming totally Hindu. Much of the distinctiveness of the Parsi community comes from its ancient tradition in Iran. The ancient sage Zoroaster founded a religious tradition that for many centuries dominated there. He taught that there is a constant conflict between the forces of good on one hand and those of evil on the other. He also taught humans should respect the purity of the three prime elements, fire, water, and earth. That meant, among other things, that Zoroastrians should not cremate, immerse in the ocean, or bury their dead. Instead, the body was exposed to the air and predatory birds within open-roofed towers of silence. Until the coming of Islam in the 8th century, Zoroastrianism was the state religion of Iran's Sasanian Empire. According to the Emic history recounted by Zoroastrians in India, when Islam arrived, they fled in order to remain true to their faith. They found refuge in the trading ports of the Gujarat region of India. According to most commonly told versions of their origin, these refugees were at first refused entry by the local Hindu king. He showed them a bowl filled to the brim with milk. The message was that nothing more could be added without symbolically his kingdom overflowing. But when the Zoroastrians sprinkled sugar on the milk, not only was it absorbed without overflowing, but it also added sweetness. So the king then accepted Zoroastrians under 5 specific conditions. First, they should explain their beliefs to the king. Second, they should abandon their own language, Parsi or Persian, and adopt the local language, Gujarati. Third, their womenfolk should wear the Gujarati-style clothing, with the sari wrapped in a distinctive way so that the end comes over the right shoulder and drapes across the chest. Fourth, their menfolk should disarm and live peacefully as merchants. And finally, they should not disturb the indigenous population with wedding processions during the daytime. Indeed, all these describe how the Zoroastrians, who are also known as Parsis, have lived in India. But Edic scholars interpret this account as revealing both how the Parsis actually reached and settled in India, and also how they explain their origins to themselves. Scholars believe that, instead of arriving as refugees, Parsis were actually part of a long-standing trade diaspora network throughout the Indian Ocean, especially linking Iran and India. When Muslims converted their homeland, the merchant enclaves in India did not convert. Hence, they are the remnant of that diaspora network, even though their homeland is no longer part of it. The 5 conditions all justify why the Parsi culture looks so similar to the local Gujarati Hindu one, at least outwardly. While they are to explain their beliefs to those who wish to listen, they're not to force it upon others through warlike behavior or intruding on their social space with processions. Their adoption of Gujarati language and clothing, especially for women, suggests that when the Zoroastrian male merchants set up outposts on the Indian coast, they married local women who brought many Gujarati customs into their households. While Zoroastrian doctrine demands that both parents be Zoroastrian, historically it appears from genetic evidence that intermarriage of Zoroastrian men, traced by their Y chromosome, and Indian women, traced by their mitochondrial DNA, did occur, with their children accepted into the community. Further, although this is not sanctioned by Zoroastrian doctrine, 3 distinct social classes have developed. These function much like Hindu varnas. The highest are hereditary priests. They preserve and teach the Zoroastrian texts in the liturgical Avestan language and perform the pure rituals like tending to the sacred fire. Then there is the general Parsi community, who have predominantly been merchants. The lowest group are the people who carry the dead into the Towers of Silence and prepare them for dismemberment there. This division shows some of the power of the surrounding Hindu society, which leads most incoming groups to conform to its principles. If they do so, then the rest of society does not interfere in their domestic culture, but rather treats them just like another set of jatis. As outward-looking merchants centered on the commercial ports of Surat and later Bombay, today Mumbai, the Parsis were among the most successful communities during the period of European colonialism. Parsis adapted quickly and effectively to the opportunities that these Europeans opened up. Some Parsis traveled to Europe, while many more studied European languages and sciences and customs. Parsis were some of the early brokers who profited by working with the Europeans, who did not know the local market or production conditions, and also by working with Indian artisans who hand-manufactured the products that Europeans wanted. Some of the early shipbuilders were entrepreneurial Parsis who expertly combined European designs with Indian teak wood and workers. Parsi men often adopted prominent features of European clothing, while in public, while Parsi women largely continued to wear their distinctive sari, perhaps with some embellishments taken from European patterns. Some of the leading corporations in India today, like the Tata Group, were started by Parsis who adapted to business opportunities in India and then in the larger world. They often combined commercial acumen with a sense of social responsibility. So there are many philanthropic institutions and organizations started and run by Parsis. But the Parsi community has been shrinking over the last century. More educated Parsi youth marry late, marry outside the community, or do not marry at all, and they have fewer children. At present, there are only about 60,000 Parsis left in India, and they are aging, with a third of the entire community over age 60. So the Parsi community may not contribute as much to India's future as it did over the past millennium. Let's turn now to the second community. The term diaspora had first been used by Greeks in West Asia for their own dispersed and exiled community, and it was adopted by Greek-speaking Jews to describe themselves. So it's especially appropriate when we talk about Jewish communities in India as part of a trade diaspora. The oldest of the three major Jewish communities in India was located along the southwest coast, especially in the port city of Cochin, now called Kochi, in the Indian province of Kerala. There was a well-established and at times prosperous settlement there since ancient times. But there's no agreement about how ancient they were. Some emic accounts claim that these Jews were one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Other emic accounts say they were merchants who came to India to trade in the 8th century BCE and stayed on. Others say that they were refugees who fled the destruction of the Second Temple around 70 CE. Written records of a Jewish community there date only from about 1000 CE. Whatever the actual date of their arrival, there is much historic and genetic evidence that they were descendants of Jewish people from Yemen. The settlement became and long remained a major trading port on the Indian Ocean trading route. Later ethnographic research shows that this Cochin-based community of Jews developed two subgroups. One kept the name Pardeshi, meaning foreigners. They claimed direct descent from Yemeni Jewish people and appeared largely of that same genetic heritage. Ranked below them were people who became known as Black Jews. They also claim direct Jewish descent, but there's Eddic evidence that they have mixed Indian and Yemeni ancestry, or only Indian ancestry. Historically, merchants who traveled overseas were mostly men, and when they settled, these immigrant men sometimes married local women. We also know from surviving documents that Jewish families owned Indian slaves, some of whom may have assimilated into the religion of their masters. In addition, local Indian men and women may have converted to Judaism through personal or group conversion due to faith in Judaism or desire to associate with a prosperous community. The Cochin Jewish community reached its economic peak during the period when the Abbasid Caliphate, based in Baghdad, flourished for the 5 centuries starting in 750 CE. Baghdad was a major focal point for Eastern Jewish communities, including all three living in India. Their sons often traveled there to be educated in one of the two leading Babylonian yeshivas. Their highest religious authorities and secular courts were also in Baghdad. Since Jewish students and people seeking justice came to Baghdad from throughout the Jewish diaspora, including East Africa, Egypt, Arabia, Iraq, Iran, India, indeed throughout the Indian Ocean region, they felt bonds of trust with each other. These trust networks made commercial arrangements among them more reliable. This was particularly important when a shipload of goods was sent off to a distant land, and the profits would not arrive back for a year or more. As the Abbasid Caliphate expanded its authority over the northern and western shores of the Indian Ocean coast during the 9th and 10th centuries, it created conditions that fostered prosperity for merchant communities trading there, including Cochin Jews. Commerce flows best and investments are most encouraged when conditions are predictable. The caliphs minted uniform gold and silver coins that were accepted throughout the region. This meant that merchants could make contracts in a standardized currency, knowing exactly what the price was and the value of the profit and interest they would receive. The Abbasids created postal systems of communication that allowed merchants and bankers to receive reliable information about market prices and conditions throughout the Indian Ocean region. They also established codes of law, including tariffs charged on goods entering and leaving ports that were generally recognized. Since Jews were theologically recognized by the Quran and Islamic scholars as people whom God had once chosen, they were accorded the legal status of Zimmi, protected subjects. They had to pay a special tax, but also held rights under Muslim rulers. This status as living within the rest of society, and yet also apart from it, is a prime characteristic of a trade diaspora community. Since the Cochin Jews had distant relatives and trusted members of their community living throughout the major ports of the region, they were well situated to profit from all of these Abbasid innovations. They all shared a common commercial culture that used Arabic script as well as Hebrew characters to write their Hebrew language documents and correspondence. Some also contributed to literature, medicine, pharmacy, and other high culture in the Arabic and Persian languages. Recently, scholars using the famous Cairo Geniza records have been able to recover many aspects of their daily and commercial lives from the period of that commercial peak under the Abbasid Caliphate. In strictly religious terms, any paper that refers to the Jewish God must be ritually buried in a geniza or storage chamber within a synagogue or a graveyard. Since most legal, commercial, and even personal documents containing such references were not simply discarded, they were piled up in the geniza. In 1864, a traveling scholar found a huge geniza in a Cairo synagogue that contained over 250,000 manuscript fragments dating from the 9th to the 19th century. Many of the documents from the 10th and 11th centuries were from Jewish merchants from the Cochin region trading in Egypt. They describe events and feelings of those people, giving us a rich but fragmentary picture of their lives. The famous Indian novelist Amitabh Ghosh used these documents to write his In an Antique Land, which provides a fictional but historically accurate reconstruction of that world. But the Central Asian Mongols destroyed Baghdad in 1258. With the collapse of the Abbasid system, the prosperity of the Cochin Jews in Kerala declined. The second major center for Jews in India was the trading center of Bengal. There, they became known as Baghdadi Jews because they came overland from Iraq through Iran, across Afghanistan and North India. They too sent their sons to yeshivas in Baghdad, where they formed networks that would provide mutually beneficial links for international trade as the former students returned to their trade diaspora communities around the Indian Ocean and Bay of Bengal. Much artisanal production, especially hand-spun and hand-woven cotton and silk cloth, concentrated in Bengal. Merchants throughout North India brought raw materials and finished products down the Ganges River, where the Jewish and other traders shipped it overseas. They also purchased products arriving from Southeast Asia and China. Thus, these merchant communities prospered from the extensive commerce that flowed in and out of the Bay of Bengal. The third major Jewish community settled on the upper western coast of India. This community became known as the Bene Israel. Their origins are disputed. Many in the community claim direct descent from the Jewish biblical tribes. But many outsiders propose one or another later date for their arrival in India. They may have been a branch of the Cochin Jews. They seem to have settled first in Surat, now in the Indian province of Gujarat, which was a long-standing trading center with sea links up the Persian Gulf and Red Sea to West Asia and the Mediterranean. After the Surat port silted up, many moved to the new British trading outpost of Bombay. The oldest active Bene Israel synagogue in present-day Mumbai dates from 1796, during the period when the English East India Company governed Bombay. Since the Bene Israel lived in the thriving British-ruled port of Bombay, they lasted longer than the other two Jewish communities in India. However, when Indian and, more importantly, Israeli independence came about in 1947 and 1948, respectively, most Jewish people immigrated to Israel. The total number of Jewish people in India declined rapidly. In 1947, there were about 17,000 Bene Israel, 6,000 Baghdadi, and 2,000 Cochin Jews in India. Today, the total number for all three is about 5,000, mostly Bene Israel. In fact, one Cochin synagogue dating from 1539 to 44 lacked a minion of 10 males and was closed and transported to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Overall, the long history of Jewish communities in India may be coming to an end. But they were not the only trade diaspora community that added richness and diversity to Indian society. The third major minority community that we'll consider in this lecture are called Syrian Christians, since they follow the Eastern or Syrian Nestorian form of Christianity and have Syriac as their liturgical language. The Nestorians were a branch of Christianity that had split off over doctrinal issues in the 5th to 6th century and based themselves in Persia and Syria as the Church of the East. So the Syrian Christians who settled in India were an Eastern outpost of this distinctive branch of Christianity. Like the Cochin Jews, they are concentrated along India's southwest coast. They also have several emic origin stories. The most prestigious account of their origins includes personal conversion by St. Thomas, one of Jesus' own 12 disciples. St. Thomas is said to have come to India in 52 CE. He reportedly converted high-ranking Brahmins along the Kerala coast, building at least 7 churches and dozens of apostolic shrines. He then famously moved on to the Tamil coast before being martyred and buried near Madras, today Chennai. His tomb at St. Thomas Mount remains a major pilgrimage site. Another emic origin account has a different Thomas doing the conversion. This was a merchant, Thomas of Cana, or perhaps Thomas of Jerusalem, traditionally dating to 345 CE. He reportedly married 2 different Indian women, both of high birth. His descendants by one wife concentrated in the northern part of Kerala, and those by the other wife concentrate in the southern part of that region. In both these origin accounts, the Syrian community of Christians claims an outsider status who came to settle in India, but also recognized Indian ancestry as well. Significantly, both paternal and maternal sides were of high origin Christianity and Hinduism, respectively. Edic scholars concur that the Syrian Christians probably have mixed cultural and perhaps biological ancestry, but scholars highlight the predominantly biological ancestry of this community. They describe a process like what we saw for Jews, merchants who came from the West across the Indian Ocean, interacted with local Indian people, and established families with them. But there was also much conversion of Indians not of that descent. To some extent, the Syrian Christians were also a trade diaspora community like the Cochin Jews. They still recognized the religious authority of Syrian patriarchs. The merchants among them prospered from their overseas commercial networks in the Indian Ocean and as far east as Indonesia. They also benefited from the authority of the Abbasid caliphs. From the earliest European merchants who began to arrive and see around Africa from the 16th century also benefited them. But the Syrian Christian community also had and continues to have more extensive roles within Indian society. They speak the local language, Malayalam. Many fulfill ritual duties like those of Brahmins, being approached by people, Hindus as well as Christians, who want purification. They boast a tradition of heroic bishops. They also have a hereditary priesthood coming from a powerful clan that claims to have been chosen for this by St. Thomas. Select members of that clan become archdeacons who remain celibate, although their office often passed to a nephew. Many other Syrian Christians were prominent soldiers who served Hindu kings in the region. They had the reputation as especially fierce and fearless fighters. They received high honors and grants of land for their martial and administrative service to these Hindu rulers. Outside social scientists also see how pre-existing religious institutions were adapted by Syrian Christians. For example, St. Thomas Mount appears to have been a religious shrine before the Christian era. It sits atop a prominent 300-foot-high hill, the kind of place that would have been considered sacred by many cultures. There are even ancient carvings of peacocks at the shrine, which may suggest the worship of the Hindu god Murugan. Muslims also venerated the site as a shrine to one of their holy men. So this was evidently a sacred place that Syrian Christians converted even as they themselves did so, re-sanctifying it to St. Thomas, their Eddic ancestor. As their numbers rose, Syrian Christians established inland pepper plantations and trading links that stretched into the interior. They also seem to have intermarried with the powerful Nayar Hindu community of warriors and landholders, some of whom converted to Christianity. Leading Syrian Christian families held prominent positions as donors to major Hindu shrines, temples, and festivals. So the Syrian Christians have always been less marginal, as it were, to the local community than were Cochin Jews. Instead, they were a more distinctive minority within the larger Indian society, but they generally ranked high in both economic and also social terms. By the mid-17th century, there were reported 200,000 Syrian Christian families in Kerala. The 1871 census confirms this scale, counting about 500,000 Syrian Christians, which made them a majority of the total population in particular districts of Kerala. When Roman Catholic Portuguese explorers and commanders began to reach India directly from 1498 onward, they regarded the Syrian Christians first as potential allies, but later as heretics. The Portuguese had been searching in the east for the kingdom of the legendary Prester John, and some thought that the Syrian Christians might be it. Further, as powerful warriors and landholders with strong connections within the society and economy of the Kerala region, these Syrian Christians appeared to the Portuguese to be useful clients. There were some early benefits to both sides. But as the Portuguese established their own chain of coastal enclaves in India, they needed the Syrian Christians less. From their perspective, the Syrian Christians turned to a series of bishops and attendant monks coming from the Syrian Patriarch. From the 16th century, 9 such delegations reached Kerala, and more followed later as the Syrian Patriarchs recognized the value of India's Syrian Christians. As historians, those arriving prelates and the Syrian Christians who received and honored them posed a theological challenge to Portuguese authority derived from the Roman Catholic Pope. The Portuguese, for example, took over the shrine to St. Thomas, building a Catholic church under their control in 1523. They discovered bones there that they proclaimed those of the saint himself. A few decades later, the Portuguese increased their pressure on the Syrian Christians to convert to Roman Catholicism. Many did so, but others did not. As we'll see in future lectures, these tensions between Europeans as new outsiders and Indian people would persist as European colonialism began to assert itself over India. In the next lecture, we'll look at how and why Muslims and Islam came to India, following some of the same patterns we just saw for Jews, Parsis, and Christians, but involving quite different interactions with Indians as well.